imagine. You and your husband are lying on your straw-lined bed. Outside the turf-roofed cottage, the wind howls down the glen, bringing icy sleet that gathers under the thin door. The child within you kicks, and you're reminded of your other child asleep in the crib beside you. You lie awake, feeling the warmth of your husband's body, and you gather the woolen blankets to fight off the draughts. You remember the two sleeping soldiers just beyond the threadbare curtain, and notice that the fat one is not snoring tonight. Blessed relief. There is little food left in the house now that winter is at its worst. Feeding the soldiers for the past 2 weeks has eaten into the meagre store. But as your husband reminds you, it is the duty of men in this harsh, barren land to be hospitable to guests, even if they are unwanted. So you do your duty. The feeling of something awry, something out of place, starts to rise from deep inside of you. The snoring. That's not right. Every night for a week, the fat one has snored. Now, only silence. Was that a shout carrying over the wind? You see the faint shadows of figures passing the boarded window. Something is happening outside. You awake your husband, and whispering, tell him of your fears. He reaches under the bed for his sword and tells you to stay in bed. He pulls the curtain back, and you see his shadow going through to the animals on the other side of the screen. Their shuffling and snorts seem agonizingly loud, but then you feel the wind rush in from the open door as your man goes outside. It seems both like no time at all and an eternity before you hear shouts and raised voices. A scream pierces your consciousness and a pistol shot cracks. You can make out the lights of torches outside your door. Suddenly, the cottage door bursts open and your husband stands there in his shirt with a lighted torch. His sword is red with blood and he is screaming at you to gather your son and come. Now! Scooping up the baby and wrapping the blankets around you both, you follow him outside. On the ground, you see the lifeless body of Ian, your neighbour, his face bloodied and bloated from a pistol shot. You see through the sleet torches and figures and moving around randomly through burning houses. Your husband thrusts the torch in your hand and drags you and your child around to the back of the cottage and on up the valley a little way. Go to the Shielings, he demanded. You'll be safe there. I will get your father. And with that, he kisses you and his son before turning back to the village. You will never see him again. You follow the path higher and higher, the torch in one hand and the now silent baby in the other. Looking back, you can make out fires where your cottages once stood, and you still hear screams being lifted on the wind. A figure behind you calls your name, and you find your father and other relatives escaping with him. He is crying out, "Murderers! They have killed us! Woe is MacDonald!" As a group, you make your way higher and higher towards the summer pastures and the shelter which you know awaits. But this is winter, and in winter the high pasture is not the pleasant place it is in summer. It is now an inhospitable snowfield, where the winds scream across Rannoch Moor into the wall of mountains that surround Glen Coe, before being funnelled down into the narrow valley towards the sea. You are very, very cold. The sleet has turned to snow, and the woollen cloth is now sodden. You remember that your child in your arms has stopped crying, and you look down at his now lifeless body, his face blue with cold. So ended the massacre of Glencoe, 13th of February, 1692.
Cruel is the snow that sweeps Glencoe and covers the grave O'Donnell. And cruel was the foe that raped Glencoe and murdered the house on the bough. They came in a blizzard, we offered them heat, a roof for their heads, dry shoes for their feet. We wined them and dined them, they ate all our meat, and they slept in the house of MacDonald. Oh, cruel is the snow that sweeps Glencoe and covers the grave of MacDonald. And cruel was the foe that raped Glencoe and murdered the house of MacDonald. They came from Fort William, we murder in mind. The Campbell had orders, King William had signed. They taught the sword, these words underline, and leave none alive called MacDonald. Oh, cruel is the snow that sweeps Glencoe and covers the grave of MacDonald. And cruel was the foe that raped Glencoe and murdered the house of MacDonald.
The Glencoe Massacre, as told in the song by the Corries, is a simplistic, romantic tale, and it's one of two different enduring myths surrounding the events that took place in Glencoe on the night of February the 13th, 1692. One is of the innocent, childlike, noble savages murdered in their beds by the cruel and evil government agents, and that's the one I think most people hold to. And the other is to simply dismiss it as a culmination of the interminable clan feuds between the Campbells and MacDonalds in the wilds and highlands of 17th century Scotland. The truth, as ever in much of Scotland's history, is much more interesting in either of these accounts. The MacDonalds were indeed murdered in their beds by members of the rival clan Campbell, who were acting for the government, but it must be set against the politics, history and even geography of the scene in order to understand how and why it happened as it did, and why the death of around 100 peasants in an age known for its brutality and high death rate is still important even today. Glencoe is one of Scotland's most awe-inspiring glens, especially when approaching from the east, and the bleak high moorland of Rannoch Moor. From the King's House Hotel, the traveller is presented with a narrowing defile between tall mountains, the only diversions being the dead-end road down Glenetive to the south and the old abandoned military road over the Devil's Staircase northwards to Kinlochleven. When you get to a place known as the Meeting of the Waters, you are entering the middle part of the valley. And even the modern roadway has to be hewn through the side of rocks to get through here. The vista eventually opens slightly onto bleak, flat-bottomed valley with towering cliffs on either side. To the right is a long ridge of impassable mountains, and to the south is the peaks known as the Three Sisters, each one separated by a closed valley. The glen then opens onto the circular loch Achtriachtan, with the long-since-abandoned township once skirting its shores. From here the glen takes a sharp right northwards to the sea at Loch Leven, and from there it is the only fertile area the majority of the population lived at the time of the events. So we have a narrow glen which crucially could only be accessed from the two places, and which could, if so desired, be blocked at either end to contain the inhabitants. In the late 17th century, the area was known as the home of the MacDonalds of Glencoe, an offshoot of the powerful MacDonald clan that had once been Lord of the Isles and capable of challenging Scottish kings. These Glencoe MacDonalds were the poor cousins, however. Their lands were not capable of supporting more than a few hundred dirt-poor crofters who scratched a meagre sustenance from raiding what crops they could in the few warm summer months, their only assets being the black cattle they owned and could sell in autumn. Any income they had was augmented by that traditional Highland pastime of cattle thieving and acting as a mercenary for other richer clans. The list of accusations against them by their neighbours over the years was lengthy. Plundering, howing, which was inflicting injuries, hairship, which was willful theft and destruction, wasting and thieving.
They were not averse to murder and were noted for their violence in an age of extreme violence. But it should be noted that the Western Highlands was a lawless place, a long way even from Edinburgh, and violence was often the only way to ensure you survived. Most Lowlanders looked on the Highlanders the way most early Europeans looked on Native Americans, as savage inhabitants of a savage place. And as long as they stayed in the Highland fastness, then they could be safely ignored. It was only when the clans became a threat to wider society, such as when supporting King James, that the rest of the country stood up and took note. The chief of the MacDonalds was Alistair MacIan, 12th chief of Clan Ianabracht of MacDonald. MacIan was a larger-than-life character, hugely tall and red-haired, and in 1692 was 62 years old. He was a veteran campaigner and had fought at the Battle of Killiecrankie under Viscount Dundee, and in the initial Jacobite uprising after the Glorious Revolution of 1688. He had also taken a prime role following that battle, when returning to his glen, he and his troops passed through Glen Lyon and had destroyed the lands of a man called Robert Campbell of Glen Lyon. They stole and destroyed more than £8,000 of his property, effectively making him destitute. Glen Lyon eventually took up a position in the King's army just to survive, a move which would eventually lead him to become a prime mover in the massacre a few years later. The Glorious Revolution of 1688 saw the usurpation of the Catholic James III's crown by the Protestant William and Mary. But the majority of Highland clans, despite their lawlessness, had a simplistic view that the king was the king and he must always be supported. They could not countenance the overthrow of a divinely appointed monarch, even if he was a Catholic. But they were also pragmatists. While they did not actively support William and Mary's rule, they could not actively oppose it either. This was especially true when no rebel leader arose after Dundee's death at the Battle of Killiecrankie, and the clans simply waited behind their mountain walls to see which way the wind went. Scotland was still a separate country at this time, despite sharing the monarch with England. She had her own government and parliament and could and did act separate from English aims, and this led to a problem when these aims conflicted. William cared little for Scotland, seeing it as no more than an appendage that had come with a vastly superior, and at least financially, English crown. He therefore left the running of the country to his appointed Secretary of State, John Dalrymple, the first Earl of Stair, who was an able politician, with all that accolade implies, who could steer a middle course through the convoluted world of late 17th century politics. It was Stair who would take the blame, at least officially, for much of the events. Two other politicians need to be mentioned here. Archibald Campbell, the first Duke and 10th Earl of Argyll, the most powerful clan chief in the Highlands, and who was seen as loyal to King William and the government in Edinburgh. Technically, it was to Campbell for whom the MacDonalds owed the land in Fiew, but in practice, MacIan would not have recognised Campbell's overlordship. The other politician is John Campbell, 1st Earl of Breadalbane. Breadalbane, known as Grey John, was one who could stand firm for King James, or King William, whichever was most advantageous to him at the time. After Killiecrankie and the rebellion in Ireland in 1690, King William recognised the need to try and at least contain the Scottish clans, which may have proved useful to the exiled King James. So Stair was given the task to carry out these orders. Several schemes were suggested, and a fort of garrisoned soldiers was constructed at Inverlochy, just 20 miles north of Glencoe, and called Fort William. This had the effect of quieting, or at least warning, some of the more truculent clans, especially nearby Cameron of Lochiel, that the government meant business, even if it did not bring wholehearted support for William. The fort was ably managed by Colonel John Hill, an English career soldier who, in the eyes of many historians, comes across as a reluctant participant in the events, and who did everything he could within his limited power to bring the clans to William peaceably and to avoid unnecessary bloodshed. Grey John of Breadalbane, as a Highlander, was tasked with negotiating with the Jacobite chiefs and was given a large sum of money to oil the wheels in the negotiations. In the spring of 1691, Breadalbin summoned the chiefs to his castle, and armed with £12,000 in his pocket, set about trying to persuade them to William's cause. Now Breadalbin strode two worlds. Like the attendees, Cameron of Lochiel, Keppoch, Glengarry, MacLean of Duart, Stuart of Appin, and of course MacIan of Glencoe, he was monarch of his own glen. He had a retinue of armed soldiers, of pipers and bards that could tell of the deeds of his ancestors, but he had his other foot firmly in the politics and Whig government of Edinburgh and London. To cap it off, he was of the hated Clan Dermid, the Campbells, who since the fall of the Lordship of the Isles had steadily increased their power and influence at the hands of their neighbours. But gold is a great leveller, and some did sign an oath to suspend hostilities and were duly given funds. Breadalbin refused, however, to hand over any monies to MacIan, insisting any monies paid were actually owed to him for previous depredations by the Glencoe MacDonalds. This was a crucial act, and one which would give the government an excuse to take action against MacIan and his clan some months later. We cannot know if Breadalbin foresaw the eventual events. It is unlikely he had such prescience, but he must surely have known that MacIan could not accept such an affront to his dignity, and therefore would be prepared to isolate himself from the other signatories to the oath. To MacIan, the rapine in Glen Lyon, which was Breadalbin's kinsman, was done and war. The king was prepared to forgive his actions in the Battle of Killiecrankie, but Breadalbin could not forgive the theft of a few cows. Then to MacIan this was a personal insult, and to a proud Islander this was unforgivable. To Breadalbin, this must have seemed like an ideal opportunity to isolate that sept of vipers, which had been a thorn in his and his kinsman's side for generations. If the other clans agreed to keep the peace, then it would afford him the opportunity to deal with the MacDonalds of Glencoe, and to remain within the law. But Grey John did not get a chance. Stair felt that the oath to keep the peace was insufficient, and persuaded King William that he ought to raise the temple. On the 17th of August, he announced to all that had previously been in arms against the government must now swear an oath of allegiance. The persons who have been in arms before the time foresaid, and shall plead and take benefit of our gracious indemnity, shall swear and sign the oath of allegiance to us by themselves, or the sheriff clerk subscribing for such as cannot write, and that before famous witnesses betwixt and the first day of January next to come, in presence of the lords of our Privy Council, or the sheriff, or their deputies, of the respective shires where any of the said persons lived. Essentially, the king was demanding that an allegiance be sworn to the sheriff clerk before the 1st of January, 1699. Stair wanted nothing more than to have the excuse to finally get rid of those hated Highlanders. These were the people who had had the audacity to ignore the new reality. James was gone and William was a new king. He knew that this oath would be a step too far for many clans, forcing them to act in open rebellion and giving Stair the ideal opportunity to display his loyalty to William, and in doing so no doubt further his own career. So, to recap, MacIan of Glencoe was a minor clan chief in a remote valley who was a thorn in the side of the more powerful Campbell neighbours. The new king, through Viscount Stair, wanted to neutralise any loyalty to the former king by enforcing an oath of allegiance, and Breadalbin used the authority given to him from his chief, the Duke of Argyll, to outlaw the MacDonalds of Glencoe, against whom he had a personal score to settle for the crimes committed against him and his kinsmen, especially Campbell of Glen Lyon. To a Highlander, the taking of oaths was a sacred and noble thing, except when it could be rationalised away, of course. And to many clan chiefs, they could not swear an oath to the new king until relieved from their oath from King James, now in exile in France. And many waited until James sent word telling them it was okay. Stair counted on this not being forthcoming, but by late December, much to Stair's annoyance, this had been delivered to all the clans. This gave them all a few days to get to the sheriff clerk and sign the oath before the 1st of January 1699 deadline. MacIan and Glencoe, because of its remoteness, never got word until only a day or two to spare, and realising the seriousness of the situation, he had not signed Breadalbin's initial oath, and if he failed to sign this one, he could be in open rebellion to the crown. Set out in the snow to Fort William and Colonel Hill. Unfortunately, Hill had no authority to accept McKeon's oath, and advised him that the nearest magistrate was in Inverary, 60 miles south. Hill gave McKeon a letter for the magistrate, explaining the situation that the chief had got to him before the deadline. It took the chief and his retinue 3 days to finally reach the seat of Campbell Power, Inverary Castle, on the 2nd of January, as the weather worsened, only to find the magistrate was absent for Hogmanay. McKeon and his vassals finally took the oath on the 5th of January. Stair and Breadalbane now had their victims. Stair selected the Duke of Argyll's regiment for the task of showing these rebels a lesson in royal power, and the officer in charge was Campbell of Glenlyon, the man whose property had been destroyed by McKeon 10 years before. The plan was to billet the troops in Glencoe, and for others to climb the military road over the Devil's Staircase and block the escape routes to the east, catching the hapless outlaws in a trap. Glenlyon and his troops arrived in early February, and the unsuspecting MacDonalds offered them the traditional and expected Highland hospitality. Campbell was related by marriage to McKeon, so it was natural that he stayed with McKeon himself. It was quite probable that Glenlyon did not know the ultimate reason why they were there, thinking it was for tax collections which could be paid in kind by billeting troops, as this was the order he gave to McKeon and showed. The MacDonalds were split between two main settlements, one at Invercoe near the shore of the sea at Loch Leven, and Achtriacton further up the glen. McKeon and his son shared a house near the shore, while the rest of the clan lived in turf cottages which they shared with their cattle and animals. The troops were billeted upon the inhabitants until Glenlyon received orders from his commanding officer, who had arrived in the glen, that they were hereby ordered to fall upon the rebels, the MacDonalds of Glencoe, and put all to the sword under 70. You are to have special care that the old fox and his sons do upon no account escape your hands. The troops had to see that this be put into execution without feud or favour, else you may expect to be dealt with as one not true to king nor government, nor a man fit to carry commission in the king's service. Early in the morning of 13th of February the troops struck, eventually killing 38 men in their homes or as they tried to flee. Many people grabbed what they could and ran into the hills and glens to find what shelter they could within the snow. No one knows exactly how many perished of cold and exposure, but most estimate around another 40 to 50, mainly women and children. Not all the soldiers were willing to carry out such heinous orders. Some tried to warn their hosts. Two, Lieutenants Francis Farquhar and Gilbert Kennedy, broke their swords and refused to take part. They were arrested and imprisoned, but later given evidence in the subsequent inquiry and exonerated. The other troops coming over from the east were delayed, allowing many to escape. Whether by snow or conscience is difficult to know. The news of the massacre soon reached London and Edinburgh and Paris, the home of the Jacobites and King James. This was a propaganda piece of the highest order for them, and the cruel murder of the innocents became their cause célèbre. Even so, there was still much unease in the legal and judicial circles that the government had simply ordered the killing of its own citizens, even if they had been technically outlaws, without due process, and pushed for an inquiry, and after a few years of pushing, one was eventually instigated. The difficulty, however, was to find those responsible for this obvious crime, and yet to ensure the king, who had signed the initial orders to extirpate the clan, was not to be caught up in it. The inquiry eventually found that it was murder, and the Viscount Stair was the main culprit, aided by Breadalbane. They recommended that a committee be formed and presented recommendations to the king on suitable punishment. But with that, it was quietly shelved. But the very fact that inquiry had been instigated at all was a victory of sorts. For the first time in British history, did we see popular demand forcing the government to investigate its own actions and hold them up for scrutiny. The fact that no one was punished is hardly surprising. Nepotism and money talked in the society. but it showed that the government could no longer act as a law unto itself completely. The massacre became a romantic tale of the evil Campbells against the innocent MacDonalds, but it was much more important than that. It was the beginnings of a popular protest against government excess, of nascent democratic demands that would lead to the Enlightenment in the coming century. If you visit Scotland, a visit to the Glen and its excellent visitor centre should be high upon your list of places to see. Well, thanks for listening to my latest podcast on Scottish history. Apologies for the lengthy delay between them, and there will be another one eventually. I can't say when. I'm afraid I do this as a part-time hobby. Can't really devote an awful lot of time to it, but I hope somebody gets some information and interest out of it. I'd love to hear from you, so if you want to email me, please do so. It's Scots History, that's S-C-O-T-S History, all one word, @gmail.com. Thanks, and until next time, Slantcha.